All right, welcome back to Computer Science E259. My name is David Mayland. This is Lecture 11, WSDL SOAP and Web Services. So this material is actually a lot of fun, perhaps just as much fun, if not more so, than stuff we've done in the past, particularly because it's becoming increasingly popular. And there are an increasing number of web services and similar technologies that are freely available, publicly available, that one can simply interface with via the languages or protocols that we'll touch upon tonight. But before we dive too far ahead, let's, as we always do, take a brief look back at where we were last week. And that was with schema. So that was our second of two schema lectures, the latter of which we focused more on data types and on complex types and on simple types, which probably, if you're anything like me, is certainly quite confusing the first time around, since everything is either simple, complicated, or complex, or some variation thereof. But here we had our most simple of types. In a word or in a sentence, how would you summarize what is a simple schema type? Something that's just text, though arguably all schema types are ultimately just text. Sorry? So that's true. They don't have children. They don't have child elements. What else is true about simple schema types? No attributes as well. And there is still remains a distinction between simple types and, for instance, complex types with simple content. So a simple type, yep. Atomic, or it's a primitive. So the type on which a simple type is based is, as in this case, a primitive, like a string, like an int, and so forth. Whereas when we began to look at complex types, we began to create hierarchies of types. We began to look more at extensions or restrictions of existing complex types and so forth. So simple types really are as simple as they might get. But we did look at complex types, the most simple of which were those with simple content. What did it mean if a type was complex but had simple content? It can have attributes. So think of it as one logical step further than just a simple type. It's like a simple type, but it allows for one or more attributes. So we discussed last week briefly that you could pretty much implement a simple type with a complex type if that complex type has no, for instance, attributes. So in English, what is a size type? If there is an element in an XML input document and you are told that that element is of type size, what does that mean, just in English? It's an element with a value of small, medium, and large. And let's be more precise now. What do you mean by a value of? I'm sorry?
Which extends the simple
content. Well, true. But when you say that it's the element's value is small, medium, large, what does that mean? Sure, it's textual child, or it's textual children. The concatenation of them is but a string, small, medium, or large. Contrast that with ever so slightly genes. If I tell you some element is of type genes, what does that mean? Oh, let's go here.
Sorry.
That's okay.
It's like something.
Okay.
Except it has an attribute called sex.
Okay, good. So it is an extension of the existing notion of size, which we just spent a moment on, but with the addition of an attribute called sex, which it in turn can take on a value of male or female. And notice in particular here that attributes by nature are always of simple type. For the reason that they can't themselves have children and attributes themselves can't have attributes, so it makes perfect sense then that you see that we have a nameless type defined for this attribute called sex. And I say it's nameless, why? It's an anonymous type, equivalently. The attribute called sex is of anonymous type, sorry? It's understood. What do you mean? Okay. Browning point for honesty.
The simple type element there doesn't have a name.
Right. So we haven't defined this simple type to actually have a name. We've simply inlined the definition. So there's an implication that we're never going to reuse this simple type. But we are using it in this context to define exactly what sex is. Right? Contrast this with size, which we similarly said was a simple type, but we gave it a name. And we subsequently referred to that name elsewhere, and we could use that name elsewhere to specify that some element is of that type. But here we have simple type, the XML schema element, but with no name, hence it's anonymous, you can't reuse it. But that might be perfectly reasonable. So building upon complex types, we move then to something with element-only content. So in English, what is an element of type person structured like? Yeah, this one's sort of easy because you sort of have an example right there. But a person element, if it's of type person, and notice this is sort of a coincidence that the element happens to be named the same thing as the type in this case. So we seem to have an implication that a person is a complex type, but it's a sequence of, it has rather a sequence of children, a first name, which is a string followed by a last name. Let's dig deeper here. When we say sequence, what is necessary to bear in mind about a sequence vis-a-vis other options we might have put beneath complex type? It has to be in that order, first name followed by last name. If we did not want that requirement, that restriction, what could we replace XSD sequence with? Okay, I heard a couple of things. Let's hear them again, but... I'm sorry? Okay, so you could say all, XSD all, or there was another option which doesn't achieve the right effect but an alternative effect, choice. And what did choice imply if we had substituted choice here? One or the other. Suppose that you wanted to allow, for whatever reason, for two last names. Well, why is it the case that XSD choice implicitly implies one or the other and not, you know, a choice of those elements, a couple of them, three of them? Okay, that's true, but there's something particularly implicit about XSD choice that we always said had some default value that in fact implied that it was a choice of one or the other rather than zero or more or two such elements. It's these two attributes that kept coming up.
Yeah.
Right, so min occurs, max occurs were perhaps the two most commonly cited attributes last time because they were often implicit in these elements, and because their default values in most cases that we've considered are just one, the implication for XSD choice, were we to put it where XSD sequence appears there, is that you must have a minimum of one occurrences of whatever in that choice block, but a maximum of one occurrence, hence the implication that it's, in effect, one or the other. If you overrode that and instead said max occurs, being careful of your capitalization, equals 2, without specifying min occurs, thereby leaving it at an implicit 1, what would be valid children of a person element if we were to override max occurs as follows? What could a person have as children? Two first names or two last names or one of each, which probably is not the effect you want, hence the earlier suggestion of using XSD all. Okay, good. Moving from element-only content, we went to mixed content, which was a trivial change. The only addition required to allow for PC data in addition to child elements was what? Yeah, mixed equals true, the implication of which is that its default value or implicit value, if not specified, is obviously false. Mixed content is sort of a loosey-goosey type way of defining an element, as you might see here. It makes sense in something like a paragraph tag or a div tag, as we've often said in something like XHTML, where you want to intermingle semantic markup with actual data, or rather character content. Here's perhaps another, perhaps more contrived example of a letter element that similarly has some metadata tagged inside of it, but still reads, if you strip away that metadata, as a sort of user-friendly piece of text. So it might be appropriate in a case like this letter element to say that a letter is of mixed type, so that it does have children, but it also has PC data intermingled within. Finally, empty content, which might seem strange. If this is a complex element or an element of a complex type and yet it's empty, well, what can empty elements nonetheless have? Attributes, right? And even in the world of, say, XHTML, even the most empty of elements like BR or HR, even without attributes, can have some assumed meaning. In this case, we specify that an element of type product is simply an empty element, but it does have one attribute whose name is prod_id, and that is ultimately of type XSD positive integer. And for a refresher on all the available types in XML schema, you can look either at that very large and hierarchical chart that we included from the recommendation in, I think, last week's lecture notes, any online reference or book or so forth. There's a good 40 plus of them. But fortunately, as in the case of schema itself, you can kind of just say what you mean, and it tends to be a type in schema, positive integer. All right, so on the agenda this time are these five main topics: web services, RPCs, SOAP, WSDL, and then Axis, the latter of which is an actual toolkit, not a protocol per se. Yeah?
Is there any difference between the XSD and the XS namespace?
Good question. Is there any difference in examples we've seen or examples you've seen elsewhere between using XSD colon and XS colon? Let me punt to the audience for a moment. Okay, here, depends and no. Okay, what you, here's a...
I said you can define it to be X. You can define XS namespace using XSD or XS.
Right. It ultimately boils down to just a convention or a developer's choice. So some people use XS colon, some people use XSD colon. You could use foo colon. It all boils down to what prefix you define by specifying usually in the root element of your document XML NS colon some prefix equals whatever namespace URI you want to associate with that prefix. So our convention in the class is XSD. It's pretty common. You might also see XS. But XSL colon, SVG colon, those two are conventional but ultimately arbitrary and certainly within your discretion. Good question. Other questions on schema? Those of you walking in late missed out on our announcement that we have not brownie points tonight, but brownies. And those playing along at home are certainly invited to pause me at this point and go get something from the fridge if you would like. As we move on to tonight's agenda, web services. So in your own understanding, if one such understanding exists already, what is a web service? Okay. Okay, it's a way of exposing data universally so that others can get at the data. Can you be a little more specific?
Well, like, if you have an API to get at an application,
okay,
you can wrap that API into a web service, and then you can basically URL to that web service.
Okay.
To
okay. So a web service is really an application that's exposed via the web or really via the internet via an API that others can hook into. So it's not quite a CGI application or an ASP application, which typically are these web-based applications. So you say they're web-based applications, but the user interface ultimately boils down to what you can do with a web browser. A web service is sort of one level lower, one level closer to the developer, whereby a web service is an application whose API, whose public methods and so forth, can be executed by, in theory, anyone on the internet. Often web services run, quote unquote, on port 80, which tends to be a convention. They're web services to some extent in that they tend to run over port, the HTTP port, port 80 or perhaps 443 for SSL, but that too is somewhat convention. They ultimately boil down to nothing more than an XML-based RPC mechanism, but the beauty of them often boils down to the availability of tools which very much simplify the means via which you can interface with these web services. And that's what you'll be doing in Project 4, to interface with Amazon's electronic commerce service. That's what we'll be doing tonight with a couple of demonstrations. And in general, that's what you do. The quick history of web services is that back in 1998, there was proposed a protocol known as SOAP, a simple object access protocol, which is simply an XML-based language, meta-language, with which you can execute the equivalent of RPCs, or remote procedure calls. And just to get a sense of the audience, how many of you have experience in any language with executing RPCs? Okay, so about half. And this is in contrast with what you might rather verbosely call LPCs, local procedure calls, but those are just function calls, method calls on a local machine. As soon as you introduce the R to RPC, you start talking about invoking methods or functions in whatever language you happen to be using, but that are executed elsewhere. You have the illusion of them being executed locally, but there's often a network between you and the server actually executing them. XML RPC is a distinct protocol. This is what we actually demonstrated several weeks ago when I gave that quick Wormboy demo between client and server, which happened to be running on the same machine for convenience at the time, but in effect could be running anywhere on the internet. SOAP since 1998 or 1999 essentially has gone through several revisions. There was a good deal of industry support for it, and it remains one of the more popular implementation of the general notion of web services. But there are web services are pretty much as we define them, web exposed applications that you can hook into via APIs. The underlying implementation protocol is sort of irrelevant to the notion of a web service in and of itself. We'll focus for now mostly on SOAP, if only because it tends to be among the more popular and one of the best supported, at least in some of the toolkits that we'll take a look at. Web services, in terms of their architecture. So this is some sort of fluffy architectural description of them that pretty much uses more words to describe what we've already described, so we'll gloss over some of this stuff. But for those less familiar, remote procedure calls are something worth spending a moment on. So a remote procedure call typically can be viewed as the coordination between two pieces of code, a client and a server, in effect, the former of which allows a developer to write or to use what's typically called stub code, S-T-U-B. That stub code is written in such a way that it hooks into what is called on a server side a skeleton code. The idea being that it's the skeleton that actually implements the interesting piece of functionality that the developer ultimately wants to make use of. The stub is simply a hook via which a developer on machine A can invoke a service that happens to be running per its skeleton on, say, machine B. So the underlying implementation of the stub is to handle the necessary socket call, TCP/IP, UDP, whatever it happens to be, all of the boring underneath the hood implementation details that as a developer, you or a developer typically wouldn't want to deal with. It's not that interesting rewriting your own remote procedure call or reinventing that wheel. You would simply like to be able to call a method foo and not care about how that stub, foo, actually communicates with the server that actually has the skeletal code that's going to implement the interesting functionality and then get the response, the return value, in programming speak, back to the stub code. So in the world of local procedure calls, stub and skeleton are sort of one and the same. Only when you separate them via an internet or a network do they become these distinct notions. The beauty of web services as implemented by a language like SOAP is that you, the developer, do not need to write really the stub and in effect don't need to write the skeleton either. Ultimately, you do need to write the interesting code that implements some interesting functionality. And let's just make this more concrete. A commonly cited web service, trivial as it might be one for stock quotes. Simply a web server that is running on the internet, that if you pass it a single string, a stock ticker symbol like APPL, it will reply to your inquiry with the current stock price of, say, Apple Computer. So a very simple service. Makes sense to run it on some server because you, the developer, certainly don't need to be hosting your own stock ticker symbol server. You might as well just grab the data from someone who actually keeps that data up to date. And so what SOAP allows you to do as the developer is not have to write the code with which client and server actually communicate. All of the code that implements this connection between server B and client A can be automatically generated. And that is perhaps one of the most compelling features about something like web services as based on SOAP, because so much of that, those low-level details can be automatically handled for you. And you, the developer, can just assume that there exists in this world a method called getStockQuote And all you have to do is pass it a string, a stock ticker symbol, and thereafter, you don't need to worry about how it is implemented. The only thing you need to bear in mind is that, unlike LPCs, there is now a chance, however slight is the probability, that what might happen? Right, the network might break, the service might break, so whereas in the world of LPCs, if you wrote the code yourself, you can be pretty sure that if your code is implemented correctly and you call a function, that function will return, and it will return deterministically the value you want. Well, as soon as you introduce a network layer between you and your underlying implementation, well, you now have to expect or anticipate the worst, which in, say, JavaSpeak might be the throwing of an exception, which doesn't mean that your parameter was improperly formatted. It might instead mean that the wire between you and the server broke, the server was overloaded, the server's not available, whatever. You don't necessarily get back your answer anymore. And that can be a problem for either performance or reliability, but it's a trade-off, of course. So what is SOAP? SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol, is simply an XML-based language that allows you to serialize, in the form of text, a stream of text, across a network, what is generally known as an RPC. So what do you think we need to serialize across a network connection to actually implement a RPC using XML? In other words, developer on computer A calls some method getStockTickerSymbol, passing in a string, which is supposed to be a stock ticker. How in real terms, or what in real terms, must we capture in this XML fragment that's subsequently going to be sent across the wire to the server? So it is a request. So what kind of information needs to be embodied in this request? So probably minimally the procedure that we want to invoke on that other machine, the presumption being that maybe it's designed to do other things as well, and certainly the parameter, so the input to that method. There might be a whole bunch of other metadata involved depending on our implementation, but at the end of the day, the two most important things we need to include is what we want, and we want to influence the behavior of that call via its parameter. Let's ignore for the moment this world of web services and SOAP. If you were back in the day simply trying to implement your own notion of a remote procedure call, and what you, the developer, had access to wasn't SOAP or XML or any of these toolkits that can supposedly automatically generate all the stuff between A and B, but instead, all you have is the standard C libraries, fwrite and fread calls, and open for socket connections and close and so forth. How instead might you implement this notion of an RPC? It's okay, if you haven't taken a network course, you can just roll your eyes and think, this isn't for me. But you can do this, and this is how people have been doing it for a while. How do you do it?
Sure. F write, then do F put, F get C until you get the
file. All right, so F open, open a socket using the operating system's assistance, pass specifying the host that you want to use, get host by adder, that sort of function call first, specifying the TCP or UDP port you want to connect to. Once you have that open socket connection, you want to do an fwrite or an fput to actually push your inputs across the wire, which are probably going to include the name of the method you want. Well, what do we in real terms need to do here? Well, we'll probably want to null terminate the string that we spit across the wire that represents the method name so that the server can figure out where the separation between inputs is, because after that null character, we're probably going to want to pass along the wire the stock ticker symbol, after which we want to put another null terminator or new line character, whatever. The server, meanwhile, needs to be also implemented by you to do a listen on whatever port is in question and doing an fget constantly. As soon as some traffic comes in, it needs to parse that string that comes across the wire. It then needs to parse the stock ticker symbol. It then needs to figure out what, with a string comparison, what method or function it needs to invoke on that machine. It needs to then pass that parameter, the stock ticker symbol, to that function, get back its answer, do the same thing, and get the answer back. So it's not hard, and it doesn't probably take all that much code, but it's not interesting code. And it's code that you would be implementing like everybody else just to implement a very simple notion, the execution of remote procedure calls. So what SOAP does, among other things, is just get rid of that nuisance so that you can focus on solving the interesting higher-level problems without worrying about the underlying implementation of the RPC. But you do pay a price. In fact, I believe with Wormboy, I may have given you a quick preview of the actual XML data that was going across the wire. Yes? No? And what was interesting about it? It was large. It was huge. It was verbose. And what Wormboy in particular was doing was sending essentially arrays of numbers across the wire that, recall, captured the number of invocations of various system calls. So simple arrays, which collectively could have just been spit across the wire as contiguous 32-bit chunks. That probably would have been the most efficient way of doing it, ignoring compression. However, instead, because I was using XML RPC, every number that I sent across the wire was marked up with, among other things, an XML tag I4 for a 4-byte integer, followed by the integer itself, which was just a string, followed by the close tag, and then this was wrapped in a special tag that said, here comes an array. That was wrapped in a tag that said, here is the name of this array, and so forth. There was a lot of data just to ultimately send a simple array, but it's a trade-off, of course. Now, one argument to be made in favor of nonetheless using XML is, well, if you start marking up your data so redundantly anyway, it actually compresses pretty efficiently. And you'll see hear of or read of these silly or cheesy things called XML routers even, which are, you know, nothing more than dedicated boxes perhaps on a network that has a lot of RPC, XML-based RPCs going on. They pretty much run gzip on all the communications from one end to the other. But XML does actually compress fairly well, even with the most naive of compression algorithms. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The short comment here is that there's clearly downsides to a lot of the automation that we're about to look at and the verboseness of what is being generated. But the upside is that it's convenient, and it allows you to focus on the more interesting stuff more quickly. Yeah? So it's a good point. Isn't it dangerous to allow remote users to execute code on your server? Arguably, yes. But the data that they are passing in is nothing more than character data, which you can certainly check for errors. You always run the risk, whenever you accept user input, of having buffer overflows, which are responsible perhaps for most server compromises to this day, at least those written in C or in C++. But it's a trade-off. If you want to get user input, you have to clearly accept user input. At least, though, in the world of XML, what's nice, too, is that what underlies this implementation of SOAP, as we'll see, is similarly a use of the schema stuff we talked about the past couple of weeks. So we're borrowing, as you'll see, the syntax and the data typing embodied in schema so that your applications can at least expect that the data you are receiving will be present, but will also be present in some expected structured form. And that alone can be useful. So one thing that's worth noting, though, especially for those of you who have dabbled in other worlds of RPCs, none of this is new. Like, before this class, before 5 years ago, before 1999, you could still execute RPCs. You could implement them yourself, or you could use off-the-shelf solutions like DCOM, CORBA, Java RMI. There's nothing new and nothing magical about any of the stuff we're discussing tonight, SOAP in particular. It's yet another way of doing things. But one of the most compelling features of web services as based on XML or SOAP or XML RPC is that they really are platform and language neutral, unlike a lot of these previous technologies, which also some of which were tied to specific companies or proprietary implementations. We're really talking about open standards, which helps certainly with their popularity and adoption. There's three aspects to a SOAP message, as we will dub it tonight. It has an envelope that essentially has some metadata that says, here's the structure of what this SOAP message looks like. It has a set of rules to express instances of the data types that are embodied in that message. This is to say, when you execute an RPC using SOAP, and again, to be clear, you won't have to write any of this code yourself, you can send over the wire not just primitives like 4-byte integers or characters. You can send across the wire student objects or news objects or user objects, borrowing some of the data types from our previous projects, which themselves were Java objects, which in turn had primitives as data's primitives within. But the beauty of SOAP and the toolkits around it so that you don't have to implement any of the marshalling and unmarshalling of these otherwise fairly complicated data types. You simply have to pass to your method foo a reference to a student object, or a user object, or a news object. And you can let SOAP figure out how to transform that Java object in RAM to an X-string-based, XML-based representation that gets sent across the wire and at the other end gets converted back into a Java object or C++ object or some other object depending on the language in which the skeletal code is actually written. So it's a good question. Who's responsible for the correctness when it comes to these underlying transmissions? It is, in reality, up to the developer, but it really boils down to the correctness of the tools that both client and server have used. We'll focus, as we do in Project 4 tonight, on an Apache tool called Axis, which allows you to automatically generate the stub and the skeletal code that we've been discussing tonight. If Axis is correct, the underlying implementation will be correct. And it avoids the problem of the developer even having to know what SOAP is. Third, a convention for representing remote procedure calls and responses. That is only to say that SOAP messages, ultimately, are standardized. But what they look like is not necessarily important to you, the developer. But looking, as we try to do in this course underneath the hood, let's take a look at one such request. Well, SOAP, given that it tends to be the language used for a lot of web services, that is, the language via which they communicate, client and server, here is the result of my having run the equivalent of a packet sniffer on my computer while accessing, in this case, Project 4's warehouse web service. So if you've glanced ahead or read through the entirety of the specification, you know that the final aspect of Project 4 involves some interfacing with this web service called Warehouse. That warehouse is designed to take what as input? A purchase order, a PO element, which currently does very little, but if you've begun tackling that part of the project, probably has more data being sent with it. And it's responsible, this service, for responding to a PO element with what kind of element? A PO ACK, or PO, a purchase order acknowledgement, which, as the spec prescribes, needs to include some redundant information from the PO itself, but also some back order information or quantity information as to how many of the purchased items were actually fulfilled in the order. So what you see here is the result of my sniffing a transmission between my implementation of Scamazon as it invokes the warehouse web service. And again, to be clear, Project 4, for simplification, runs both Scamazon and the warehouse in the same instance of Tomcat. That's simply so that you, the developer, don't need to arbitrarily run the warehouse on one box and Scamazon on another. It's simply convenient to run them in the same instance. But the code is written in such a way where there's a layer of abstraction whereby it would be very easy to move the warehouse to any other server, not even on nice.fast, but on any machine on the Internet. So what you see at the top of this file is clearly an HTTP header, which suggests, as has been implied by the notion that these are web services, is that when you execute an RPC, or rather, when you write code that uses a dynamically generated stub that in turn uses SOAP to communicate with some skeleton on some server, what you're doing is simply making an HTTP request, just like a browser does. But the message included in that HTTP request is not the incredibly trivial get string that is usually included in most HTTP requests, but rather an XML fragment. And see if you can infer from this excerpt alone what is in the SOAP request from Scamazon to the warehouse. Just describe in any words you feel comfortable with what the SOAP request includes.
It includes like a
It, in effect, includes a purchase order object, or really a PO, just a string in this case. Because the method that we have implemented for the purchasing service, which we'll look at in more detail in a bit, simply accepted a single parameter. And that parameter was a Java string that was assumed to be an XML fragment. Notice that there's not even any structure that's retained in the SOAP message, because the Java code itself, recall, is simply designed to accept a string. It's not designed to take a DOM node. It's just designed to take a string, which per the project specification had better be a string of XML, whose root element is a PO element. But what you see here is interesting. We have inside of this envelope, capital E, which is the root element for a SOAP message, we then have the body of the message, similar to in concept to what HTML does. What's curious about this next child element? It's the name of a method. So somehow or other, whatever code is implementing the SOAP transaction between Scamazon and the warehouse service has chosen to define an element that happens to be named identically to the method that we actually want to invoke. So per our conversation earlier, this is where, in effect, the method that we want to invoke on the server is actually captured in the request. Where is the parameter to that method captured? Yeah, so the zeroth argument is of type XSD string. So this is a schema instance. This is a schema document string. So these are just namespace tags that are all reiterated there, and we've seen those before at this point. So we're clearly borrowing XML schema's data typing mechanism. But the value of that string is quite simply this. This less than symbol PO slash greater than symbol. So in fact, I sniffed this communication between Scamazon and the warehouse at what point in the development process? The very beginning, right? Before po.xsl is even doing anything interesting, because this out of the box is what Project 4 does per the specification. But what you see with this packet sniffed result is that what we say is going on behind the scenes is in fact going on behind the scenes. All right, so this HTTP request is received by the warehouse service because of the way the code has been written on the server side, and because we are using access on both ends. This XML fragment, this SOAP envelope, is demarshaled or unmarshaled in such a way that ultimately passed to the process PO method on the warehouse server is what? Just a string as its sole parameter. So what does that method ultimately respond with? Well, per the specification, and maybe per your own familiarity at this point, the process PO method is supposed to apply POAC.xsl to whatever string you receive. Out of the box, what does POAC.xsl return? Just a string, and what is that string? As I recall, it's just the very uninteresting POAC empty element. Well, here is a response that I sniffed during the same experiment. This is the HTTP message that the warehouse sends back to the Scamazon service as soon as it's done executing the process PO method, which might take a millisecond, might take a minute, depends on how busy the server is, but ultimately this is the message that goes back. Notice that the response element is now called process PO response, which I, the developer, didn't decide on, but Access, the toolkit that dynamically generated the protocol that these two clients and servers are speaking, chose. It is passing in a return element, the return value. So just as methods and functions in C and Java can only return one thing, whether it's an array or a reference or a primitive, similarly, does the web service only return one thing, which in this case is a string, and that happens to be precisely what you would expect it would return. Yeah.
Limited by what access besides is the tag for the
So why do... So Axis isn't really limiting us to the choice of these element names, because to us, the developer, they're irrelevant, because we, the developer, never should be seeing this message go across the wire. So these elements could be called A, B, C, D, E. They should still work, but it's irrelevant to me what they're called.
But how would they actually... I mean, but so obviously someone decided that we're going to send...
Yes.
You're going to send a response with a tag in that format.
Yes.
Where was that decision made?
So the folks over at Apache that implemented Axis decided that when you dynamically generate code for the purchasing service, which has pretty much as its sole piece of functionality a method called process.po, the convention they adopted was to define the element for the return value to be name of the method followed by capital R return. It's arbitrary, but so long as the client knows what to expect back, it is correct. And we'll see in a moment how the client knows that that's what he should expect back. Other questions? When do we generate the code? That is an excellent question. And let me propose for now that I answer that only partially as we work toward it. If we take a look at Project 4, for instance, and I go into the source directory, into the warehouse directory, recall that there was just one class provided, purchasing.java. Notice that this class is simply a purchasing class. It's not a servlet. It doesn't extend Wahoo servlet or Scamazon servlet. It doesn't extend HTTP servlet. It is just a Java class in the most boring sense. It's a class, a public class called purchase. The only method implemented inside of this thing is the method called process.po, but then we do specify a error listener class, which just helps with parsing errors. It's sort of uninteresting for our purposes tonight. The only interesting functionality is this process.po method, and even though it's a dozen or so lines of code long, they don't collectively really do anything more than apply poac.xsl to the string that was passed into the method. That's all. And we've seen that kind of code before, back as far as Project 3, when we were playing around with Wahoo. So that's all this thing does, but that sort of begs the question, where is any of the code related to this? Where is any of that actually involved? Well, what happens when you actually compile Project 4? Let's do an ant clean and run ant again. And notice that after a couple directories are created, 149 source files are compiled. Those are just for Amazon's web service for the most part. They are not files that you will yourself need to touch. These six files are written by us. And then there's this one file here that's being copied ultimately to warehouse WebINF classes. So let's take a look at where that is. In web apps, warehouse WebINF classes, there's now a CSCIE 259 directory. Way down inside of that are a couple files, purchasing.class and purchasingErrorListener.class, and then this purchasing$1.class, two of which are essentially anonymous classes that were inlined in the code. The interesting one is purchasing.class. Well, let's take a step back in this hierarchy, back up to the WebINF directory. Notice in the WebINF directory, there's this file, web.xml. Web.xml, meanwhile, is almost always the file that's used to actually specify that a JSP is running here, that a servlet is running here, and so forth. But there still doesn't seem to be any explicit mention of the purchasing servlet. Agreed? Okay, so there's no mention of purchasing there. Just to dispel any notions, in the server.wsdd file, there's similarly nothing explicitly about purchasing except for this very bottom part. So notice that we have an element that we added under the services comment, and there seems to be a service called purchasing here. It's going to be provided to the world as RPC, so take that at face value for now. The class name that implements this service happens to be this, which is the correct package name for the class we compiled into the classes directory. And I know a few of these things are purple at the moment, which makes them a little tricky to see. That might make it worse. But all we have in purple here is the full value of the package name for the class called purchasing. And then we have this parameter here that says the allowed methods are star, which essentially means that we are going to expose to the world the class called purchasing.java or purchasing.class, and we are going to allow any of its methods, star, meaning any, to be exposed to the world as essentially a publicly accessible API. Now, recall from just a moment ago, the only publicly accessible method in that class was, in effect, the process PO method. But I, notice, didn't have to write any special code. There is nothing in purchasing.java that even suggests that it's meant to be exposed or can be exposed to the world as a web service. And that is the beauty of something like Apache's Axis. Axis is, among other things, a SOAP router that, in effect, allows you to, in the confines of, say, your Tomcat server, to listen for SOAP requests, unmarshal them, that is, turn them back into something like Java-based, if that's the language being used, and then pass those requests, once unmarshaled, to the web services running on the machine. However, Axis does something else. Per these configuration files and per the other configuration files that shipped with Project 4, Axis itself is also sort of a servlet that listens for requests of a certain URL. Recall that the warehouse service runs where? Let me go into Project 4, run Tomcat. So we fire up our server. It's running on port 8080 on ICE2 at the moment. So I'm going to go to ice2.fas, harvard.edu, port 8080. If I just hit return, we're in the root. But if I type warehouse into the URL, that actually, if you haven't noticed this little Easter egg, shows you what your warehouse actually looks like. But if I instead go to services, and then I think it's called purchasing, I might have the capitalization wrong. I do, because no service is available at that URL. Notice this curiosity. There was, in web.xml, if you noticed it, and you can look back at your leisure, a line that essentially said, any URL of the form slash services star should be mapped to Axis, which essentially means that because of our configuration of Tomcat, which just takes a few lines of XML code in those XML files, we have said to Tomcat, if you see any request for something in slash services slash whatever, let Axis handle that request. Axis, meanwhile, because of our configuration of those files, has been told that, you know what, there is a web service running at purchasing. And it, we told it in that XSDD file what class implements this service. When you visit it with a web browser, Axis really just for convenience sake says, hey, there's an Axis-based web service here. If we click on the URL and add this, and this is an Axis-specific thing, all I've added to the URL, and you see this suggestion in the Project 4 specification, is question mark WSDL, WSDL. If I hit enter now, oh, WS, whew, there we go, it's a good save. If I so much as simply add question mark WSDL, what you get is this dynamically generated XML file. This does not exist anywhere in the distribution unless we cached it, included in the cache directory, which was just for convenience if I did that, not because it's necessary. This file was just automatically generated. How was it automatically generated? Essentially, because of our configuration of Tomcat, when this request came in for something of the form slash services slash something, that request was routed to Axis. Axis checked its configuration, noticed, oh, gee, I've been told that there is a service called purchasing, and it's implemented by csci259.project4.warehouse.purchasing.class. I now, because I see this additional parameterization of question mark WSDL, am going to generate what's called the web service description language for that service. In other words, I, Axis, am going to look at the Java bytecodes in purchasing.class, and I am going to automatically generate a generic language-independent description of what API that class provides. So if we look closely at this, this, unfortunately, like everything else lately, is very verbose, but we can notice some highlights. Notice that among the things in this file are several mentions of purchasing. That's consistent with the fact that something relevant to purchasing was dynamically generated. Notice here, though, that described in this file is an operation, which is, let's say, the abstract name for something like a method or function called process PO. Notice that this operation takes an input, which is going to be called process PO request, which again is accesses arbitrary but standardized choice of element for the SOAP request that ultimately gets fed to this service. If we scroll down slightly more, notice that also included is a specification that this operation, upon being queried, will reply with a process PO response. Well, what is a process PO response? If we scroll higher up in the document, notice that we have a specification for what those messages mean. What is a process PO request? What is a process PO response? Well, notice up here, just below those comments, we have a definition of the message called process PO response. It apparently has, or rather, process PO request first. It has apparently one part. It has a PO XML string, which we call PO XML. That happened to be the, if I go into source, CSCIU5, warehouse, purchasing Java, notice what the name of the process PO parameter was. So Access is clearly borrowing from our own code in those bytecodes. Notice that the process PO request does take one parameter, an XML string. The response, meanwhile, is going to be of type string as well. And that's consistent with, if we open this file again, what is returned by process PO? A Java string. What's returned then? Well, an XML schema string. So there's a mapping between these most basic of primitives. The other stuff in here talks about how to connect to the service, what protocol to use for the service, and sometimes what port to connect to the service if it's not on, say, port 80. But all of this was dynamically generated. So finally, in answer to your question, how do you generate the code? Well, really, it seems to be clear that you don't need to generate yourself manually the so-called skeleton code. All you have to do is configure Access in a way that effectively magically transforms your otherwise innocuous Java class into a web service. We did not have to do anything to do that. All we had to do was configure a file and say, here's a class I wrote for my school project, expose it to the world as a web service. It's literally that simple. But the more interesting question now is, all right, you've just exposed for the world to use this service that offers an operation called process PO. How do I, the random developer on the internet, actually make use of your service? Well, I could, in the conventional sense, download the SDK from your website that you might have posted, and you have written yourself code that allows me to include your library or import your library and just write code that you have, use code that you have written to invoke your service. But you don't even want to do that. All you want to do is expose to the world. You know what? Here's the wisdom. Here is a description for my web service. You figure out how to interface with it. Well, the beauty is of using something like Access or SOAP in general is it's not hard to figure out how to use it. All you need to do now is dynamically generate code that implements the protocol that has essentially been defined with this XML markup. And that's what you're using Access for. So before we pause for our break here, let's go ahead and look at one of tonight's examples, which is documented in your code printout. And there's a little README so that you can play with this at home as well, either on NICE or on your own machine. If I go into tonight's examples directory, into the server directory, all I put in the server directory is a very stripped down version of Project 4, just so that you could have a standalone demo to play with at home. Notice that this standalone demo is similarly running on port 8080. Essentially, this is Project 4, but with only the web service, the warehouse in it. The Scamazon stuff I just removed altogether. I'm going to open another window meanwhile. I'm going to go into my examples 11 directory again, but I'm going to go into clients. In clients tonight, there's two directories because there's two demos, one of which we'll do after break. Warehouse is one of them. And purchasing client is a class that I whipped up that's independent of Project 4, but is meant to be a lecture demo, but that uses that WSDL. So here's how it works. Here's a class that I called purchasing client. It has a main routine. The only two things I do in it are call this, new purchasing service locator, followed by get purchasing. So essentially these are two standard method calls that you would use to actually invoke a web service. Somewhat access specific because your toolkit, I know, dynamically generates methods called this. The service's name, which in this case is purchasing, followed by the word service, followed by the word locator. That's simply the convention adopted by Access. So here I go. If I want to get a new instance of, or if I want to get a hook, really, to that web service, I just call purchasing service locator. I then use whatever is returned to actually get a real hook to the purchasing service. You don't even need to understand these two lines of code in much depth. It's just with these two lines of code, you get back what's generally called a port. Think of it as like a socket connection that you can now talk to, but it's not a socket because you're not writing bytes. You're actually invoking methods. Because in a moment, all I'm going to do is use that port reference that was returned and call, quite literally, the operation or method that I want to invoke. And all, for the purposes of demos, I'm going to even bother doing is just passing in the PO element. I'm not even going to bother with any more structure than that. Notice that that's all this demo does. The rest is just designed to catch exceptions. And we did note earlier the downside of RPCs in general is now you have to worry about something going wrong that in the LPC world wouldn't go wrong because you have no network connection between you. But here I have an access fault, which is just something related to access or something related to the SOAP transaction or the even more generic exception, just so that I'm capturing everything with this demo. But that's it. This is effectively a three-line demonstration of how to hook into the warehouse service. But wait a minute, where is all the code to be generated? Right there. So the top line of this file happens to say import edu harvard fast ice 1 warehouse services purchasing dot star. That's a little curious. Well, if I go into the server directory and web apps and warehouse and go into web inf and classes, this is where all the bytecodes are stored for the service when you dynamically generate them yourself by running ant. Notice that there is, I lied entirely. That is entirely the wrong story I wanted to tell. In the clients directory, in the warehouse directory, there is not the code that I actually generated because that was part of this demonstration. So there is no, currently, here, fixing the story as we go. Clearly this code won't work yet because that package doesn't exist. It's nowhere in the class path. So hopefully if I try running, let's try Java C of purchasing client. Yeah, that's a problem. So there is no match for this import. So who is going to sit down and write all of the code that apparently implements what's generally known as the stub code? Well, that's where Access helps you out. And as I note in the README here, and as you see redundantly in the project specification, to dynamically generate the Java code that implements the functionality described language independently by this WSDL file, you simply tell Access to go generate it for you using this WSDL file. Specifically, you would type java.org.apache.access.wsdl.wsdl2java. The name sort of says it all. Convert WSDL to Java. Then I'm going to pass in quite simply the URL of that WSDL, which for the moment is hopefully still here, and it is. So I'm going to copy-paste that URL that we've been looking at right into the command line argument. So again, to be clear, I'm saying Access, take WSDL to Java from this WSDL file. Enter. Don't worry about those warnings for now. They happen to do with how nice is configured. The code still works. Now notice what's inside this directory. An edgy directory, inside of which are all those subdirectories. Inside of this, guess what? Several different files. Not only class files, not class files, but rather source files. Notice here is purchasing.java. We didn't write that, but we're reminded that Access did generate that for us. What about in purchasing service.java? Well, some more code there, but this just seems to be an interface, so we really haven't gotten to the juicy stuff yet. What about this thing, which we did see in my sample code, the service locator? Well, now it's getting a little more interesting. This is actually some juicy code that was automatically generated just to see what's relevant about it. Notice that captured somewhere in there is the URL of the web service. That's a good thing. It could have been, it also captures the port on which this service is running, and then a bunch of other stuff, dynamically generated, but all of which collectively implements that HTTP request that's going to be sent over to the service. Finally, there's one last file, the soap binding stub. You can look in this. This, too, is a class. Whole bunch of other stuff that was implemented, not by us, but by Access. The one difference is here that I'm running on ICE 2. So what I do quickly need to do is change purchasing client to use package name of ICE 2, because that's the machine I'm running on. We could have used a command line argument and changed the package name altogether, but I left it at the defaults for the demonstration. If we compile purchasing client.java and then run purchasing client, what should I see when I hit return? Besides those warnings, POAC. What's happened there was that PO element was sent to the process PO method on the web service, but my three-line code demonstration was designed to just print whatever this method returns, which you know from Project 4 is to be, for now, by default, just POAC. So with three lines of code and one command line execution to run Access on this WSDL, I now am interfacing with a web service that I might have learned about just 5 minutes ago. With that said, let's take our brownie break. Back. So the next several slides flesh out in more detail what WSDL messages look like. What I think would be better to do is wave our hands at that, only because a human by design should not need to know how these messages are laid out, and it doesn't particularly benefit one to know how these messages are structured, but there's enough detail there that for the curious, you can get a sense of what to look for in a WSDL message, as we did verbally. But at what we did here, I think, sort of captures the spirit of the extent to which you yourself might use WSDL to figure out how a web service operates, but realize that with web services, even though all of this can be dynamically generated, or it could be generated by hand if one so chose, typically a web service would be supplemented with documentation. Documentation written perhaps in a language-neutral form. For instance, if you download PayPal's web services API, you will get language-independent descriptions of the operations supported, aka functions, aka methods, of the parameters that those operations take, aka messages in this case, or rather inputs in this case, and so forth. You will also often get with published web services sample code that allows you to sort of infer by example how to interface with it. But the short of it is that even though the WSDL file is dynamically generated and can be parsed visually by a human, and you have in these lecture notes essentially a cheat sheet for what means what in them, that's not really the point of WSDL, human readable as it might be. It's really meant for a computer. And again, to be clear, it's meant to be a language independent way of describing a service that might be implemented in Java, doesn't need to be implemented in Java, and this WSDL in turn can be used by tools like Access to dynamically generate stub code for Java, for Python, for Perl, for C, for C++. Download the right toolkit or spend enough time on your own and you can implement this stub code yourself. But it's the availability of tools that takes the language neutral format to a language specific implementation that's really the beauty. And it allows you to pick off the shelf pretty much whatever language you might have a preference for in order to interface with this service. So with that said, let me fast forward over some of these wisdom slides to the last of them, which simply makes note of the following. Even though WSDL is designed to support fairly strong data typing of the messages, of the inputs that are going back and forth across the wire, there is sort of a looser approach that it can take, specified in what's called its binding element, where you can simply say, you know what, all I want to get across the wire is a chunk of data. I don't care so much about strong typing. I don't care about retaining the notion of various objects and structure to it. I just want to send an XML document. Just know and tuck it away, perhaps mentally, that there does exist with SOAP, with WSDL rather, a way of saying, here comes an input, and all it is an XML document, pretty much ignoring the notion of using XML schema types and so forth. So just know that that exists. It can be used just to send XML documents across the wire, rather than, say, structured data that originated from, say, Java objects. So, toolkits help automate, to be clear, the subcode, the client, based on a WSDL file that you would find via the web or would be provided with, or you can also generate the WSDL from an object. So notice we have seen both directions, and that, too, is one of the beauties of web services or of the toolkits that provide them. I did not have to write skeleton code. I wrote an implementation of a purchasing service, but the skeleton code, the code that actually talks with the stub code, was dynamically generated by Access. And that's what happened when I simply visited a URL of the form /services/something. The skeletal code, in effect, was provided automatically to you by the servlet called Access, which was configured in Tomcat to intercept any requests to URLs of that form. And that, too, is a neat thing. There is also a way, and you can see this if you look online, for instance, in Access's documentation, that if you want to get away with if you want to get away with not bothering with web.xml and server.wsdd and all of those configurations, you can actually use Access, if it's installed in Tomcat, to do something even more trivially. You could... And let me go out on a bit of a limb here, just because I don't recall precisely offhand the directory in which it should be. But I'm going to try and risk failing at this demo, going into the warehouse's webinf directory, into classes. Let's see, do I want to do this? Will that work? Well, let's give it a try. All right, so what I am going to do is go into the source directory. Which is not here, so we go into warehouse, webinf, classes, into the hierarchy. There's the class, I want the source, so we have to go into the project directory. Let's see if this works. Web apps, nope, source, warehouse. Okay, purchasing.java. I'm not positive offhand if I'm going to put this in the right place, but I'm going to copy purchasing.java just for the moment to my project 4's web apps root directory, and I'm going to rename it. Well, let's leave it alone for a moment. I'm going to run Tomcat, and I'm going to go to the root of our web service, which, recall, normally just has like index, not even index.jsp, happyend.jsp and happyaccess.jsp. So now we have purchasing.java. Not so interesting. If I click on it, all it is a Java file, so the browser's going to try to download it. But, and this is where I'm going out on a bit of a limb here, if I go into web apps root and rename this purchasing.java to purchasing.jws, and rerun Tomcat. Let's see if my memory serves me correctly. Ah, that doesn't. Try one other thing. Is this where? Web apps root move purchasing.jws to there, webinf. You run Tomcat. don't think this is, I don't think I have the config file set up right. No. That's not going to work like that. All right. I'll have to figure this out later, and I suspected that would be a failed demo. There is a way, if you configure the container correctly, that if you simply take your Java file like that and rename it JWS with the right configuration, one-liner, in your config file, that is sufficient to turn a Java class into a web service. Literally as simple as that. And then you don't have to write as much XML markup in server.wsdd as we had to in Project 4 in order to get the job purchasing.class file to actually compile as a web service. And I've goofed in terms of where you need to put it in your Tomcat directory structure and what line you need in the web.xml file. I'll figure it out and email it out. But that, too, is a powerful thing. The implication is you write a Java class and you decide, the next day, I want to expose this code that I spent yesterday writing for the world to use. It's as simple with the right toolkit as just naming it a Java web service, putting it into the right directory in your servlet container, and boom, you're done. The skeleton is automatically generated, and in turn, people can access the WSDL file just by using the right syntax and say the URL, similarly dynamically generated. So, that was a failed sneak preview of where you can put that. I'll drop you an email as to the appropriate syntax for Tomcat.
Hey,
yes? So there was originally an access directory in Project 4, which should not have been there and has been removed. It does no damage to be there, but it's not in the official distribution. And I'll check for the simplest way to actually get things up and running right after class. Let's take a look, then, at this one other demo that I whipped up, which similarly requires that we run Tomcat in the server directory from tonight's examples. That's going to fire up for us not just this particular base, but if we go into, I think, services/, what's our example called in this case, for our tax demo, we want to, oh, yes, good. Did I do it correctly this time? I did. I was stumbling across what I wanted to do when our first demo is what I wanted in the first place. So here you go. It turns out tonight's examples are configured correctly to demonstrate the power of this JWS trick. So what we have in our server setup for tonight in the server directory is, recall, web apps and then taxes and warehouse. In warehouse, recall, a moment ago, we had pretty much everything that was borrowed from Project 4, and inside of that class directory were all of the bytecodes for the purchasing class. So this was the very methodically implemented web service per the specification. But notice if we instead go into the taxes directory, I have just a file called taxservice.jws, which is just, was once called taxservice.java, and in this file is relatively little code. And we'll look at this in just a moment. In the meantime, let me back up to the server directory and go into conf. And let me just check what we've put in here. Warehouse taxes, good. And then conf web.xml, JWS, let's see. There we go. So in web apps, oh, that's interesting. It's the defaults. So the defaults on Tomcat, as we've configured it on NICE, have a line that's essentially looks like this. And this is in the defaults. It's not there is no web.xml demo for the tax service because the default files that ship with Tomcat and in turn access as jar files already support this approach. So what you see in, if you look in the default config for our Tomcat, or rather for Access, is a servlet mapping like the following, which in short, and we haven't spent a lot of time turning your attention to these config files, but they are relatively straightforward. What that essentially says is any time the user accesses a file of the form JWS, ending in .jws, redirect them to the Access servlet and let the Access servlet handle the retrieval of and the execution of that code. Okay. So with that said, if I am running the server, as I am now, from the examples 11 directory, and I go up to the taxes directory, notice that I have just this file here, taxservice.jws. And in fact, if we go into web apps, taxes, and rename this thing temporarily to Java, you'll see the effect of before, nothing too interesting. But if I rename it again to what it should be, .jws, it's still just a Java file, and click on it. One moment. No, something's wrong. Damn it. That was a huge setup for yet another disappointment. All right. Taxservice.java. Let me try one trick. Let's see if we can recover quickly. Warehouse. WebINF, web.xml, JWS. Let's see if we can cheat and just get this up and running real fast. Otherwise, I will have to get back to you. Web apps. Okay, one moment. Respawning the server after having made a couple tweaks there. Oh, what a save. Okay. Okay, I lied entirely, apparently, about how the server was configured by default, and I'll have to go back in and fix the config file for the demo. But now that web.xml is configured correctly, with essentially the only material difference being a mapping of star.jws to the Axis servlet, what now happens is Axis, as before, intercepts calls to all files of the form something.jws, and Axis then provides you with an interface. Now, web services are not, again, meant to be accessed via a web browser, so this is just sort of a convenience that Axis does this for the silly human that tries to pull it up in a web browser rather than by interfacing with it with actual code. If we look at the WSDL file, this is the WSDL that was automatically generated from my taxservice.jws file. That's all it took to generate all of this. Now, let's turn our attention to what that code actually does. Temporarily, what I'm going to do is just rename this .java so that Vim actually does some syntax highlighting for us. But what tax service has is simply, notice it's just a class. It's not a servlet. It's not an extension. It's just a class. This class happens to have three methods, which just arbitrarily calculate tax rates in three different ways. We have one method up top called calculate tax rate, which essentially means if you pass it a subtotal and a total, both of which are of type double, this method is designed to figure out what the effective tax rate was. So presumably total is intended to be greater than subtotal. So this method divides one by the other, or the difference thereof, one by the other, and figures out you just paid 5% tax. And what's returned is that rate that it happens to compute. Similarly, and perhaps equally trivially, if not uninterestingly, calculate subtotal simply expects that you'll pass in a double called total followed by a tax percent. And what this method does, just to show a different approach to the mathematics, is figure out what the pre-tax cost was for whatever you bought. Finally, calc total is even easier. Given a subtotal and given a tax percent, both of which are double, figures out what the total should be. So it would be the subtotal times 1.0 whatever the percent is. And we figure that out. So that's it. This is to say, this is what you spent all day yesterday on. You're so proud of the fact that you implemented this tax calculator. You would now like to allow the world to interface with this code. It is as simple as renaming your taxservice.java file to taxservice.jws, perhaps reloading your servlet container, or at least configuring it in a way that it automatically refreshes this. You can then tell the world via your website or newsletter that, hey, my tax service exists at that URL, which is the same URL printed in tonight's README file. So I now, in some schmo on the internet who realizes, ooh, this guy implemented this tax service. This means I don't have to implement it. I can just use his implementation when I want to calculate totals. What do I do to go about writing my own code that interfaces with his service? What does it take? All right, so I've got to one step before that. So in my in his newsletter, which I've subscribed to, I say, ooh, here's his WSDL file. What do I do? Okay, so use that URL to create the client code, the stub code that I will then interface with. All right, so I am going to be in my clients directory and taxes. I am going to go ahead then and run java.org.apache.axis.wsdl, WSDL.wsdl to Java. I'm going to pass in the URL of the WSDL file, enter. Don't worry about those warnings for now. Notice if I do an ls, I now have an edu directory, which inside of which is a tax service underscore JWS, which is just Axis's conventions for generating code from a JWS file. If you use the right command line argument, you can override this very long package name and give it any package name you want so that it's not implicitly machine dependent. This is just a result of using the default settings. Inside of this directory are four files in this case, which look very similar to the warehouse files, but embodied in at least one of them is going to be the most important piece of information, perhaps, which is where this service actually is. So web services are tied to a domain name. In the case of Harvard, potentially problematic in that these names are specific. So you'd have to do things somewhat differently if you wanted to run a web service on a cluster of machines in your WSDL file. That's not hard. So I now have this code in my client. I am going to simply say, all right, I've got a main routine. I'm going to follow the convention that Access uses and get a hook into the web service with these two lines. They look almost identical to our warehouse demo. And that's it. That's all it takes to hooking into that schmo's web service. If I now want to use it, I simply call the guy's calc tax rate method or his calc total method or his calc subtotal method, and I just call them by way of the port, the hook of sorts that was returned to me. I know that they're designed to return doubles because in this case I happen to skim the WSDL file, but hopefully in his newsletter or on his website, the guy would have provided me with some degree of documentation saying that there exists in my web service a operation called calc tax rate. It expects two doubles, which should be in this order. It returns a double, which means this. And then intuitively, I would know how to write Java code that implements that notion of calling an operation and passing in two arguments. All this code then does is completely arbitrarily pass in a few values like $21, $23, 0.10 cents, and so forth, just so that we have some numbers to play with. And if I compile this thing, taxclient.java. Oops, there's a mistake here. What's wrong? I didn't compile the stubs, but that should happen automatically. The one issue is that the original demo was compiled by me on ICE1. Just have to change that. Again, that's not an inherent nuisance about web services. That's more a nuisance of Harvard's configuration and the fact that we're running on a very specific host. Now if I compile the code, all of the stub code gets recursively compiled as well, so I can simply now run tax client. Ignore the warnings for now. These three pieces of data, yes, they happen to be executed on ICE2, but that's only because I happen to be running the server on ICE2. I could, and we'll do this just for kicks, I could go to ICE3 now, which is clearly a different machine, happens to be in the same room, but ignoring that little detail, if I go into my same examples clients directory and run tax client now, enter, notice that, ignoring the warnings, still works. And arguably it was ever so slightly slower, though I might be making this up partly, because there was a transaction going on across computers, whereas before it was just going through the loopback interface, the local host. But kind of neat. So what more can you do? Tax service was my own creation. The warehouse is our own creation. Where can you go about getting web services? Well, one of the original visions for web services was that there would exist these directories. And maybe there still will exist these directories, where if you want a stock service, you would use a certain standardized protocol, perhaps called UDDI, which was a proposed standard, hasn't really caught on in the past several years. But essentially, it was a standard way of putting web services in a directory, whereby you could find a service by some kind of descriptor for it. Give me a stock service, and you would get back an available stock service. Well, the reality is, at least for now, that if you want to use a web service, you probably go to PayPal's website and you find the WSDL file or the API, pre-generated API code, and you use that. Or you go to Amazon and do the same. In fact, what you do for Amazon is described in Project 4 spec, but essentially, after you get your subscriber ID for Amazon, you can, via some fairly unintuitive menus, find the WSDL file for their services. And that's essentially what I did to use Axis, using the same syntax as tonight, to generate those 149, give or take, files, and then I just gave you those files so that you would have them yourself. This is why, though, if you look through those source files, there's no comments. There's no documentation in the source because it was automatically generated from WSDL that Amazon provided. But realize that some folks might be nice for convenience sake and say, yeah, this is a web service, but here is some Java code that we ourselves generated for you, so you can literally download an SDK. But realize that in the world of web services, this notion of downloading an SDK is sort of a thing of the past. You access the WSDL file, or your tool accesses the WSDL file and generates the client stubs for you.
So there's no, so even if you happen to have comments in your code, when Axis runs through it, it sort of ignores it, or does it like
by default, Axis gets rid of it. Yeah, it gets rid of it. And you would look more to language-independent documentation that a human would actually provide. But one of the links among tonight's resources is this link to xmethods.net, which I'll try to make use of. It's been a little flaky the past couple days when I've tried a couple of demos, but this is perhaps the number one hit when you search on Google these days for web services. And this is a directory in the web page sense of web services. Essentially, it's an aggregator of some popular, not necessarily hugely robust, but at least available demos of web services that you can make use of. You'll notice that there's various different implementations of the web service on, say, the server end. All of them expose WSDL, web services description language, that you can yourself use to generate client code in any platform or language that you so choose. You have some descriptions of the services here. Let's go to the full list and see if we can't quickly whip something up. Here's one, a stock quotes web service. Here's one that returns Hungarian proverbs, apparently. Here's one, Department of Transportation Services fraud protection. Unclear why that would be a web service. Holiday service, it allows developers to retrieve holiday baits based on the provided country code and date range. Sort of increasingly useful, because otherwise they'd be sort of a difficult thing to integrate or annoying thing to integrate into your own application. Here's one. Sends an SMS message to a mobile phone. So that's a nice little portal with which you might interface. Historical price volume market capitalization charts for U.S. securities. Again, related to stocks. Everybody seems to like the stock demos. Let's see. Another one is, this is interesting. Instantly validate and enhance any address in the United States. So sites like UPS and USPS tends to do this these days, where if you type in your address, it'll automatically capitalize it. It might change the apartment number for you or add the last four digits of the zip code. So that's one service that you can essentially outsource some piece of functionality for your website to someone else that's providing a pay-for or a free service. Here is, well, let's instantly determine the gender of any contact record. So that's kind of interesting, especially for names less familiar to us. If it's not Jane or Alice, I struggle sometimes, for instance. Filters spam via web service. That's sort of a strange one. But anyhow, there's a huge list here. Let's see if we can pick a fairly simple one. There was one we used last semester which was called a Jive converter. So you pass it English and it responds to you in Jive, which is kind of strange but fun. Let's see if we can get one here. How about Congress members and their contact info? Well, how about this one? Returns a random quote. That sounds pretty innocuous. Let's click on random quote. Notice that this is, again, this is, none of what you see here is specific to web services per se. This is some website's presentation of a directory. What's important to us is what's highlighted in yellow up there, which is the WSDL file, which hopefully it'll work. This is the dynamically generated WSDL file. I could look closely at this and see how it works. There seems to be a get quote request, a get quote response, but if it's a good web service, there would be some kind of documentation for it, or dynamically generated documentation. For instance, this is a useful thing of X methods. I clicked analyze WSDL, which is sort of an analysis of the WSDL to make it a little more human readable. It seems to have two operations. I'm going to click that. It looks like there are two operations are called get quote and get all quotes, one of which takes an input message and returns an output message. Same for the other one. Let's see what the input message is. If I look closely, the input message appears to just be a Boolean. So it looks like I need to just pass in perhaps 0 or 1 or empty string. We'll have to see. Well, let's give it a try. Let's see if we can do this on the fly. Again, putting ourselves at risk of a failed demo here, but I'm going to copy that WSDL file, get rid of our Tomcat instance because it's just not relevant anymore. I'm going to go into a new directory, which will be called quotes. I am going to go ahead and run Java on org apache.axis.wsdl.wsdl2java, pasting in that URL. Ignore the warning for now. It takes a moment, but Axis is doing its thing. Notice it created a couple of different packages this time, Cold Fusion, XML RPC. There's a few things in there, Query Bean, CFC, Invocation Exception. What else do we have here? A comp directory, inside of which are three files, probably the juicy things. So let's go ahead and do the following. Open another window just so I can work more quickly. I'm going to call this demo.java. The top of the file, I'm going to import. Let's go into quotes. I'm going to import, just to keep things simple, I'm going to import everything. Come on. So we have Cold Fusion XML RPC. RPC, and we have the other one, which was comp, cd comp, come on. So I'm going to include comp.star. Now I'm going to have my class, public class demo, public static void main string args. Okay, so we need two lines, which by convention were to do what? So we need to locate the port. So we can kind of cheat here and take a look at what's inside of this and recall that our previous demos in, for instance, the tax client did the tax service locator, which looks a little different here. So let's see what we have to do. That's not what we want. Quote, random quote, locator. Oops. So let's see if we want to, well, that was not helpful, get that's the interface, so we don't want that. Quote CFC, that might be what we want. This is why last year I did the Jive example in advance. Good. Good, good, good. Use proxy class. Well, let's hope I don't fail you here. All right, so locator L gets new. And then inside of this locator, we want a get. Not the address, not the name. One sec. We want this to be a random quote. Ah. Quote L, get random quote. All right. And now, random quote. The operation is get random quote CFC. Now I'm skipping a step. Ah, that's fine. rather than, let's do this, rather than entirely embarrass myself by not having run through this earlier, what I'm going to do is cheat, less dramatically, I know, click the try it link. And what you have in this form here is simply, so there's the get quote routine that I was looking for. Get quote, actually, that's what we wanted. So let's see if we can save this. Grep get quote. Binding stub. Okay, that. Random quote locator. We did the locator. We got the stub. 76. Not as easy without documentation. For the get the stub implementation. All right, I will do this later to get it correct rather than embarrassing myself here. So what we'll use instead is the dynamically generated demonstration, which essentially takes that same WSDL file, generates what code is necessary in order to interface with it, and provides you, the developer, you, the internet browser, with a web-based view of what operations you can invoke. Here, because of the way the WSDL was parsed and because it specified that it takes one parameter, either true or false, whether or not you want the quote back in HTML format, we'll go ahead and say false so that we get back just the pure text of the thing. If we go ahead and click preview, what we should see in here is the actual message that's going to be sent by the code. And this is something that our own Java code would not have shown us, since it would have been behind the scenes unless we actually sniffed the traffic, as we did to get you the screenshots from earlier. But notice that inside of this SOAP envelope is going to be an invocation of the get quote operation. And we saw something very similar with the process PO implementation earlier. We have a request here, HTML format, Boolean is false, so that's just specifying the parameter, and that's it. Because this thing just gets back pseudo-randomly some form of a quote. If we then proceed to click send, what the demonstration is doing somewhat slowly was the following. It sent that request. That's in pseudocode. It's not necessarily in some language-specific approach. We could change it into the XML that was sent, into the raw request that was sent. But we'll leave it as pseudocode. What was returned was essentially the following, a map of sorts, a hash table of sorts that maps the author's name to a value of Murthy and the quote to this. For the moment, let's actually look at the XML that was actually returned here. You have the raw SOAP envelope. Notice that the get quote response is in the form of, has two items in it. So it's in effect an array that was returned of two elements. The first item was of type string. Its value was of type string. The name of that first parameter or return value was author, the author being Murphy, and then the quote that was returned. If we look at the actual quote, it is impossible to make anything foolproof because fools are so ingenious. Whatever. So that was the quote service. And what I will do, just so that I look through the access code that was generated more carefully, is either between now and section or right after section, I will whip up a demo that we can then download via the website for that actual service so that you see the Java code in action. For now, a final look at where things fit in with Project 3, with Project 4, you are ideally at the point in your approach where all that remains of Project 4 is this stuff, though it was striking the silence on the listservs this week, so I rather wonder maybe how far left we still are. But do realize that perhaps the toughest thing to estimate the amount of time of would be the integration of the Amazon Web Service, only because it really depends on what you choose to do with it and with what speed you familiarize yourself with available documentation. The reason for our having provided ecs.java, ecs.jsp, was so that you have a working demonstration of how to interface with that web service once you have your subscription ID. Bear in mind that the Project 4 code for that is in the web apps directory, in the Scamazon directory, and then in ecs.jsp. What you essentially have in this JSP file is the following. This is an awful color to have used for this. If we look at this, that's still ugly. Still purple. Oops, foo. Yellow. All right, readable, but not as fun. So this is a JSP in a more involved sense that we've typically looked at, the reason being that it uses the standard tag library, JSTL, Java Standard Tag Library, which is a useful way of actually grabbing what's otherwise Java data and then iterating over it using programmatic constructs like this, for each construct in this case, and actually then outputting things iteratively in your JSP code. Essentially, what this code does is the following. You are ultimately generating an HTML page. In the body of that web page is going to be a list of somethings. Well, what are these somethings? Well, apparently we are using the JSTL, which is using a prefix of C in this case, arbitrarily, is iterating over each item, where those items are somehow coming from the request scope, that is the request objects dot items element, which think of this as sort of a object that has been tucked away in something similar in spirit to the session. So you're iterating over the object called items that's been tucked away here. What you're doing with these cout tags is outputting the value of the current items, item attributes called title. After that, you're outputting the item's author, its first author, hence the bracket zero in case there were multiple authors, followed by the publisher, followed by the publication date, followed by the ISBN. Later, you are then outputting with a little bulleted list any reviews that exist for that particular item, for that particular book. Meanwhile, in our source directory, you have ecs.java. And this is the servlet that actually, first of all, expects your subscription ID, which for demonstration purposes, if you want to play with this, just paste your subscription ID right there and then recompile the code with ANT. Notice that statically compiled into this code is just a list of ISBNs, which happen to be the four ISBNs of the recommended books for the course. Then notice that all we do with the first two lines of code here, essentially, first three lines of code, real code, is using the dynamically generated code that we provided you with that came out of Access from Amazon's own WSDL, is we got a hook into the Amazon Web Service. And then we use these several lines of code to actually query that web service by way of an item search request object for information on those various ISBNs. This should make a little more sense when you actually look at the online PDF or the online HTML for the Amazon Web Service, but the means by which we knew to call things like those four lines of code and then to call these three lines of code were because we looked at the documentation, either the language neutral one or some of the sample Java code, to figure out how the Amazon API is exposed to you. And the reason this one should strike you as a little more involved is because that web service does way more than our simple tax service and therefore involves way more than just the three files that Access saw fit to generate previously in our examples. Finally, essentially what this code does, and if you read through it and its comments, it should be more clear, it stores in an array called items each of the item objects returned by the Amazon Web Service. The final lines of this file, meanwhile, tuck away that items array into the session and then pass control over to ecs.jsp. And it's in ecs.jsp via this thing called the JSTL, proceeds to iterate over that same array and in the confines of dynamically generated HTML, output salient information from each of those item objects. So that was quick, but the spec provides you with a bit more detail and also the comments therein should get you started. But certainly make use of the listserv with more questions. So with that said, let's call it a night. Some extra brownies and milk on the way out. And I will see you for a section where we'll focus a bit more on web services as they relate to Project 4.